Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In 1927, a discovery in Folsom, New Mexico, led archaeologists to realize human history in North America went back far further than anyone had previously believed. In the century since, more intriguing discoveries have introduced the Clovis to the wider world. Helping us understand just what the Clovis is and was is Jason Pentrell from the wonderful Seven Ages podcast. But before Jason educates us on the Clovis, don't forget, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Please visit our exclusive merchandise site for your t-shirts, mugs and stickers, available in TeePublic, and the link is also in the show notes. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Let's join Jason then, as we go on the search for the Clovis. It's not even a century ago, yet, when the whole perceived history of human habitation in the Americas was turned on its head, the 1927 discovery of Pleistocene humans clearly showed evidence of what became known as the Clovis. Joining me to clarify this archaeological history, this intriguing culture, is researcher, writer, and podcaster, Jason Pentrell. Jason, I'm delighted to welcome you to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, well, thanks for having me, Paul. I'm happy to be here. It's something I've been looking forward to for a couple of weeks now, so it's going to be a good time.
Well, let's see how we go.
as we do.
It's something I've been wanting to dive into, Jason. Obviously, we've spoken off air, and I was very humbled to be invited onto your show at the beginning of this year to join you for a chat about weird and wonderful things. And obviously, over the last few years, I've become very aware of the work yourself, Michael Hanks and James Waldo have done in regards to the Seven Ages research and what's been going on in this. And for somebody not based in North America, I'm completely intrigued by this whole sort of pre-indigenous Native American culture, as probably the rest of us would realize it now, Jason, because I think for a lot of us outside of the US especially, we get to hear very little about Native American and First Nation culture and history anyway.
And then to discover that there's a whole civilization that predates what we believe to be the Native American, for me, I just find it incredibly fascinating. For you, as someone that, very similar to me as a child, had a love of all strange, wonderful archaeological things and digging in strange locations, probably. Was this on your agenda as a child, or were you one of those people that was enticed into it through dinosaurs and Indiana Jones, and then everything else has sort of followed on from that?
No, I was really one of those children who was born with the fascination. So my mother used to have to drag me around to all of the historical sites. And I live here in Charleston, South Carolina. So it's a very history-based area. And we have lots of old homes, lots of colonial archaeological sites. And then we have a long history of Native American sites here throughout not only the peninsula of Charleston, but the whole surrounding area. We have a lot of rivers and waterways here, and all of those were home to Native American sites for thousands and thousands of years. And so, you know, growing up, as I would discover more and I would get taken to a museum, do a school field trip or something like that, you begin to see the layers of history. So just understanding how far back it actually goes. And then from a child's mind, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, you think, okay, well, like, you know, the Revolutionary War was a long time ago. And then you realize, okay, well, there were people here before that. And then there were people here before that. And as you, you know, age and go through high school and then into college and things like that, you begin to understand just how long that time scale really is. And then when you get involved with archaeology, as I did, you begin to realize that there's still so much that we don't actually know. And that every single year, the clock's kind of getting backed up a little bit further and a little bit further. And with each one of those times that we have to rewrite that sort of history, it just kind of opens up the possibilities of, okay, well, if it goes back this far, then how much further does it go back? And how are we going to be able to use the modern technology, to use everything we have available today to track it back to a beginning point? And that is a point that we haven't yet reached. We're still looking for a beginning point.
Suppose, as I said in the introduction, the fact that this has only really sort of been with us for not even 100 years, because I think it was, as I said, 1927. So we're not even at the centenary of the first real discovery of this pre-Native American culture, Jason. I think it's fascinating, really, because I think sometimes you can misconstrue a nation's acceptance of its history sometimes, which might sound a bit of a strange thing, but I think lots of places tend to sort of ignore things until the evidence basically jumps up and punches them in the face, until they can't sort of say, well, no, that's not true, that didn't happen, or we've no evidence of that, or it's not sufficient enough. And I think this is fascinating for me, because I'm one of those people, as you've just referred to there, where the layers of human history, I think when you start to peel them back, it becomes more and more fascinating. And I think even for someone like myself, who's not totally abreast with everything that goes on with archaeology these days, I am sort of in touch enough to understand that there seems to have been a whole sort of polar shift over the last 30 years about human history, human evolution, the cross-pollination of species that we thought we'd eradicated. We now realize that it's basically just cross mating, and we absorb different cultures throughout our times. The discovery of other lineages in the last 30 years, the human tree has gone from being like a stick of celery to being more like a broccoli head these days, Jason. And I think this is just another branch of this all, because obviously the most fascinating aspect of this is that the Clovis seems to have only been around for a very small space of time, really, or what we would consider the Clovis to be. So clearly there were peoples before them that we still haven't really sort of burrowed down into finding out what's going on. And yet now, even in the last 100 years, the discoveries just seem to keep popping up and popping up. And it's fascinating when we look at this, in my opinion, that the most striking aspect of all this is that technically, they seem to have only been able to find the body of one particular person they could consider to be a Clovis, which I believe was an infant that was discovered in the 1960s. And that gave that whole genetic DNA lineage that suggested and sort of solidified the Siberian connection, because obviously there's a lot of that coming across the land bridge. But also it shows you that there was a lot of this going on. So there was clearly people prior to all this going on. And yet we've still got such a tiny, tiny, tiny piece of DNA evidence that we can say, I find that part of it even more surprising.
Yeah, this is a multi-puzzle piece type of thing here. There's so many pieces that are missing. And the only thing we're able to cling on to when we're talking about Clovis is mostly, with the exception of that one body you mentioned, the Anzac burial, other than that particular one, being able to trace something genetically has been a challenge, because we're talking about 13, 14,000 years ago here in North America. So really, we're having to read the stone, okay, the lithic points. Those are the things that remain. And that's really the only indicator we have, except often they are found alongside the remains of fossilized mammoths, mastodons, things of this nature, that tells us there was an interaction at that time near the end of the Pleistocene between what we call the Clovis and these giant megafaunal creatures. Now, to define this a little bit further, I think a lot of times people refer to it as the Clovis people or the Clovis culture. It really wasn't either one of those things. Clovis describes a techno-complex. So it describes a technology. And the technology that differentiated the Clovis from other people, and this was across the entire North American area and even down into Mexico, is a very distinct projectile point and knife. They were used as knives, they were used as butchering tools, they were used as projectile points. They were sort of a multifunction tool that has a very distinct style, and they include what's called a flute, which is a area struck on the basal end of the point, so the bottom of the point on either side, and it shoots up a channel flake right up the middle of that projectile. And it's been long argued, discussed, debated what that particular addition to a point would do as far as making it more effective for use, because it's not easy to do. It's a very difficult thing. And so what we see from what we would call the Clovis techno-complex is late Pleistocene hunter and gatherers. They didn't seem to have villages. They didn't seem to have any permanent settlement. They were following the migration of the megafaunal creatures, and they were using that as a food source. So they were constantly on the move. Although the research does seem to indicate, especially here in the Carolinas, that they did have a certain region in which they would stay. So we're able to track that by the type of material that they would use, whether it's a metavolcanic material from North Carolina, whether it's a coastal plains chert from down around the Savannah River between Georgia and South Carolina. There seems to be a very distinct region of area that they would work within. So they were probably able to follow migration paths within that couple hundred mile area and be able to sustain themselves well enough to continue on. So when we get into the details of, you know, when we're talking about Clovis, some of the main questions are, of course, you know, when did they arrive? When did they actually get here? So, you know, when we talk about indigenous relations, these are the direct descendants of modern day Native American indigenous people here in North America. It twists and turns through the genetic path as anything would, same as it would in European or African cultures or any other type of culture. But if you go back far enough, you will find that there is that relation. So we were literally talking about the same people that seems to indicate that they were coming from Eastern Asia into North America. However, Clovis itself actually only existed for about 300 years. So a very small window. And again, we're talking about that style of projectile point, that techno complex, very short window. And that's some recent information that's just came out. But from everything that can be predicted from the world of archaeology, that window is very, very small. And then, of course, the next question is, how did they get here? So again, that's been a huge discussion point. We get into the Beringian theory, which is certainly plausible to a degree. That land bridge did exist at some point, but there seems to be some very good indication now for the use of boats. So using small watercraft along the coast, being able to dip in and out of bays, harbors, protected areas, small islands. You have access to fish. You have access to sea kelp. You have all those things there available to you. Plenty of mammals to hunt along the shore there. Inland to be able to capture any other type of meat sources and different types of vegetation. So it's very possible that it could have been one or the other or both that they were using to come into the country. What we would call North America or the United States today, and even down into Mexico. And there's some good indications by researchers such as Tom Dillahay that they went even further south than that. So again, we're looking at a stone trail, if you will, a stone record, and we're trying to trace and fill in all of these various points. But each year we're finding more and more information, new sites, new lithic types, and all of these things. And collectively, we're just kind of plugging in those puzzle pieces wherever we can to try to get a better understanding.
What's the most northerly point that anything's been discovered so far, Jason? Because I would imagine this, looking at this, I suspect that the most difficult aspect of this is basically trying to discover any evidence of coming from sort of Alaska down, as you say, because it would make sense for you to follow the coastline rather than try and make it over land, depending on the time of year, I would suspect, because you've always got a line of sight. And as you say, you've got abundant resources there for you, weather dependent, of course, and seasons. But I would imagine the fact that even in the modern era, 90% of Canada's population lives 200-300 miles next to the American border, and yet it's still the second biggest country in the world. You've got an enormous landmass there that archaeological evidence is probably, the surface has not even been touched at all.
Yeah, those are all great points. And as far as we can tell right now, Alaska is home to one of the most northerly sites as far as we're talking about Paleo-Indian, i.e. Clovis. Now, there's some interesting information out there, because there's a lot of areas in and around Alaska that seem to have been a stopping point. So they may have came across either across the Beringian Strait or via boat, but they seem to stop right there in Alaska for quite a while. And there seems to be as if they were maybe stuck, as they couldn't move further south because of the ice wall. You got to remember, at this time, there was two major ice sheets on top of Canada, the Cordillian and the Laurentide ice sheet. These ice sheets were up to 2 miles thick with solid ice. Very Game of Thrones-ish. So it's but something that would have been extremely intimidating. You would have gotten to a certain point where you would literally be staring at an endless wall of ice. Which can be obviously very intimidating. But the thought in the past has been that there was an opening in between those two large ice sheets. And when that opening got big enough, these people were able to move down through Canada into North America. And then you have the ice sheets continuing to recede over time. However, if you really look at the way that land would have been structured as those ice sheets were separating, that land is not just going to be an open field for you to walk through. It's going to be full of lakes, rivers, marsh. It's going to be extremely difficult. Now, you have to imagine, these people are no different than we are today. They've got children, possibly mm-hmm. pets, possibly caring for elderly, and they're moving in small family groups. Moving and trying to wade your way through that type of environment would have been extremely difficult, especially for children and for people that might have been having to carry an elderly person or someone who is injured. Again, modern conveniences, we get hurt today, you just run to the hospital and get it fixed. If you're a late Pleistocene megafaunal hunter, an injury could be it for you. Infection, a broken leg could end your life. A bad cut from making one of those Clovis points or any other type of interaction, you would have to be very, very aware of. So you're not going to take the most difficult route. And so kind of switching our understanding, there's some very strong evidence that as we begin to look at that stone trail, those Clovis points that have been left for us to see in North America, rather than seeing them come down from Alaska through that open corridor and then into America, it seems that they went the other way. So archaeologically, it seems that those Clovis points are being found already in North America. And as that area opens up, they go from the south to the north rather than the north to the south. So it seems that as that area opened and it was able to dry out to a degree and, you know, those megafaunal creatures were moving into that area, they may have been able to be hunted in those southerly portions that weren't so full of all that ice and slush and water and marsh, all of those things. So archaeologically, the points seem to indicate that they were actually coming from southern location to a northern location. So that's a very interesting part of the discussion as well.
Absolutely, because that essentially seems to turn common sense on its head, Jason. You would think, well, how have they got to sort of Southern California and gone back up then? You would think. Or across, like you say, in some of the areas are all across the sort of southern belt of the US, New Mexico and places like that. So that for me is incredible because you would normally expect it, like you say. But I think it, when you look at that particular period as well, because you've got, there's so much going on at this particular period environmentally as well, because you, this is all around the same sort of period as the Missoula flood, I think it was, where the ice sheet basically broke and flooded into to the northern parts of the US, which has obviously caused some of those wonderful ripple effects you get in certain states on the plains where it basically looks like an enormous beach, because it was for a little bit. And this is all around the same period. Sort of that happens, and then you've got the Younger Dryas period kicking off. So these guys seem to have been bookended into a perfect period of exploration where the environment basically opened it up, itself up for 500, 1,000 years. And these people, were they able to take advantage of that, it would look like. But as you explained there, you would expect them to be coming in from Canada and make their way down, not start at the bottom and work their way up, which would then, I would suggest, I don't know, that they've come through the coast and landed and basically avoided all this horrible glacial stress in the north and gone round the side of it and gone, actually, we'll start here and work his way back up, and hopefully it'll have melted by then.
No, absolutely. You know, you just think of it as you would today. You know, you're going to take the easiest route. Why go through something that's innately difficult if you don't have to? And again, archaeology points to these little areas along the coast, refuge areas, these little caves and stuff where many artifacts have been found from that time period, showing that there were people there using those as refuges throughout that entire time period and even before. So we know that they were using the coast to some degree, and even things that have been found on Catalina Island. So how did they get out there if they weren't using boats? You know, and then so many times when we look back, archaeologists at the time that Clovis was being discovered, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and on up, even till today, we had a lot of gatekeepers. We had people who, you know, as archaeology began to become more of a scholarly academic science and less of an antiquarian collector's world, because that's really how archaeology started. It was wealthy antiquarians, people who could afford to go dig up mounds, who could afford to collect various artifacts. And while some of them did try to, you know, document and record some of these sites, of course, they really didn't know what they were doing, because archaeology hasn't really been developed. And even today, it's developing even more as we speak, the way that we do things. So ultimately, there's plenty of evidence, but one of the biggest controversies has always been the use of boats. For some reason, there was always this great fear of confirming that they would have used boats. But of course they would have. Even as we look later in history, we see that Native Americans used watercraft all the time. The rivers and streams, those were the interstates of the time, of the day. Why would you walk through a forest for 60 miles for 4 days when you could just hop on the river and be there in 3 hours? You know, it only makes sense. And these you know, people that were here that were part of, you know, the archaic cultures, the paleo cultures, right on up to the Mississippian mound builders, these were brilliant people. And even their interactions with the colonial settlers and pioneers, in a lot of those colonial journals, they describe how intelligent the Native American population was, how they knew how to do things, how they understood cycles, seasons, the rise and fall of the rivers, everything that they needed to live comfortably, they totally understood. And that wouldn't have been any different for a late Pleistocene techno-complex such as Clovis. They would have known how to move effectively through areas without making it more difficult. They would have understand how to get food, how to hunt or possibly scavenge large prey like a mastodon or a mammoth. All of these things would have been passed down generationally. And while it seems, you know, nearly impossible for us today, the evidence shows that they were very comfortable with this sort of lifestyle.
That's always intrigued me as well, Jason. I don't understand what the fear is in certain circles when we prescribe ancient cultures intelligence. There seems to be a real fear about it. And I don't understand why, because I think when you look at certain points in history, there are several aspects of this over here in Europe that often makes me extremely frustrated, that we're often told that the Greeks and the Romans and Alexander the Great and such like, these incredible empires that we had here, all mastered sailing and boats and being able to use them in invasions often. And yet we're expected to believe that they all got to the head of the Mediterranean and went, actually, we're not going out there. We don't want to go anywhere. We're all right just sailing around here back and forth. And I find that sort of acceptance ludicrous, Jason, because the one thing I've always found when looking at these cultures is their thirst for exploration and conquest. And I cannot believe that anybody from that particular area, even, you know, you look at some of the cultures in Egypt and obviously other parts of Africa, where you have these incredible concepts and constructions and communities and histories and knowledge bases there that we're able to look back on now and think, goodness me, this is incredible stuff. And yet when they go and look at things in North America, there seems to be this kind of aspect of, well, I don't think anybody could do that over there. And yet we keep seeing it. Recently, there was that discovery of the lost city that they found in Central America, which has basically turned the whole perception of the intelligence and community spirit of ancient culture in South America and Central America completely on their heads, because everybody seemed to think that they were all nomadic tribes up until a certain point. And now we know, well, actually 2,500 years ago, they were building cities.
No, it's a great point. And again, while we are confident that the Clovis people, that techno complex, were indeed hunter gatherers, that doesn't make it any less impressive. So if you really pull up a photograph of a Clovis point and you compare that to other types of points, you will see that that in itself is a technology. Now, I am a flint knapper, and many people in archaeology are. So we are the ones that can literally take a stone and chip it into the shape of an arrowhead, a knife, whatever the case may be. And I can tell you, to run those flutes, those center channels up a point, is extremely difficult to do. Obviously, with time and practice, you can figure it out, but it takes a lot of skill. And therefore, it had to have a reason. But really, this is the signature for Clovis Technocomplex. This is how we identify who these people were. And what's also interesting about the lithics or the stone artifacts is we have Clovis and we have something else from the paleo time period that's a little bit closer to us called the Folsom Point, which is a very thin, smaller projectile, but also equally impressive, absolutely beautiful pieces found out west. Now, as we move closer to modern times, what we see with projectile points is they start with Clovis as being very, very complex and very difficult to manufacture. And as we get closer to the Mississippian mound builders, to the modern times, the points get less complicated and they get less artistic. They are easier to make, and it's for a couple of reasons. One is because once we see agriculture get introduced, you no longer have to hunt as much. So you're not dependent upon something like a Clovis point, which was like the Swiss Army knife of the paleo world. You could do all sorts of things with it, right? So if you're only hunting deer, turkey, small game, you don't need something that complex. It would be the equivalent of today of going squirrel hunting with a 12-gauge shotgun. Like, you don't need all that firepower, right? You just need enough to get the animal down. So that's what we see as agriculture becomes more prominent, especially in the Mississippian time period, where we're seeing things like Cahokia and Etowah, Okmulgee, all these large centers, Spiro, as these city centers are growing up and around, we begin to see what's true arrowheads, which are just tiny, tiny little triangular points. And that's all that would have been needed. So really, when we talk about technology, I don't think a lot of times when people think of something like a late Pleistocene paleo hunter-gatherer, they don't think technology. They just think, the people have described it to me as almost, they envision it as like cavemen almost, which is just ridiculous and certainly insulting to these people who were able to create such masterful pieces of not only art, but functionality. So you could use it to hunt, but you could also use it to butcher, and you could also use it to, create clothing and all these different things. And so we don't know why. People ask me, well, why did Clovis start doing this? Why did they begin doing this for that 300 year period? We don't know, but somebody started doing it, and everybody else seemed to think it was a pretty good idea. So as today, trends, okay, because they had communication, they had trade routes, they were very much in contact, at least regionally. And then, of course, when somebody sits down around the fire and says, check this out, and everybody's like oohing and aahing, like, wow, that's awesome. How did you do that? Well, then it spreads, okay? And then something else that's bizarre, another bizarre part of the Clovis techno-complex mystery, is that some research was done several years ago by Drs. Bruce Bradley and Dennis Stanford. And Stanford is now passed away, but he was a monumental figure within the world of North American archaeology, very respected work for the Smithsonian, as a matter of fact. Well, he made a very controversial statement along with Dr. Bradley, and it was captured in their book, Across Atlantic Ice, which has come under fire from many different academic groups and so on and so forth. But my point to bringing this up is Dr. Dennis Stanford seemed to think that the evidence archaeologically shows that not only did it look like the Clovis points were going from south to north, but they were coming from east to west. So everything that we've just talked about coming across Beringia, down through Oregon, Washington, California, how are we seeing a progression from the east to west? Who are these people on the east? And so it almost seems, and the evidence seems to support this to some degree based off the amount of Clovis points that are found here on the East Coast, it would almost appear as though Clovis, whatever it was and whoever started it, it may have actually started on the East Coast and moved westerly. So it flips the entire narrative on its head. And all we know for sure is there was a 300-year window where people were making these highly refined stone pieces, and that they were indeed Paleolithic megafaunal hunters.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moto Casino.
America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
I suppose one of the aspects of all that is, I mean, some of the flint work that's been discovered is monumental. It's incredible. And I know there were some experiments that were run, Jason, that apparently these heads are so sharp they can pierce elephant skin, which is renowned for being one of the toughest animal hides on Earth. And once again, and sort of paralleling that, they've only recently discovered sort of ancient African culture spears, which were of a similar sharpness, to be able to allow them to hunt only using spears as well. Because I think one of the strange aspects of this is that I know people have put forward the idea that the Clovis peoples or the Clovis period ended because they overhunted megafauna and therefore they all died. Which I find ridiculous, because that just doesn't make sense at all. Because if you had a population of that many people that were that dependent on large meat sources, there would be bodies all over the place, surely. There would be burial mounds. If the complete ending of megafauna in the Americas, at the, as we were saying, when it comes to the sort of start of the Younger Dryas period, and this has kind of been put over here in Europe and Russia as well, in regards to sort of how certain cultures disappeared because they hunted the mammoth to extinction. And I'm thinking, how are you telling me there were like 100 mammoths wandering around Europe? Because the way they make it out, it would make it seem as though there were millions and millions of people running around, when we know that there clearly wasn't that amount of population at the time, because if nothing else, purely on the environmental factors, Jason, of disease, of injury, of illness, of predator attack, of their general environment. And so I think, when you look at the megafauna explanation as to the end of a civilization, I'm not buying it, because if these people are that intelligent to be able to faction tools and understand the movings of animals and be able to follow their migrationary paths and keep with them and build these camps, and also, as we've referred to, creating these incredible multi-purpose tools. We've got evidence of using boats. We've clearly got culture. We've got teaching. We've got nurturing. I find that very hard to believe, that a culture that's showing clear intelligence on that level would suddenly go, oh, well, we've no giant bison or camels or ground sloths anymore, so we might as well just die. It's nonsense.
You know, it's a great point. And it's called the overkill hypothesis. It was very popular several years ago. There's still quite a few proponents within the academic world that really still push for that. But really, you know, if you look at the basis of it, we would be saying that, you know, these people came in from the upper western corner of the United States. They swept down in a very short period of time. Remember, 300 years. And they managed to implement the Clovis killing machine that literally wiped out every piece of megafauna on the entire swath of North America. Now, again, we're talking, as you said, Paul, about very intelligent people who understand nature, understand migration patterns, understand how much can be taken in an area in order for it to maintain its numbers of population. And not to mention, a lot of the evidence, as I presented in my book, was a lot of the sites seem to indicate that in the case of the mammoths and mastodons being butchered, that oftentimes they may have actually been scavenged and not necessarily killed. And in a few cases where they look like they may have been killed, it also seems many times that the particular animal would have been mired down in mud, stuck in a swamp, had maybe not intentionally, but ended up having itself stuck in a way that it couldn't escape and made for an easy target. So many times people envision these Clovis hunters with their spears, you're running up and stabbing at, you know, a mammoth from its underbelly and rolling away before its massive feet come down to squash it. they wouldn't do that. Again, remember we talked about an injury could be it for you. An ankle twist, a blown out knee, something like that could be the end of your life. So you're not going to take unnecessary risks. But if you happen upon a mastodon who's stuck in a swamp, well, that's an easy target, right? That's easy access. The animal can't hurt you. It can't get away from you because it can't run. It can't charge you with its massive tusks. So it would be an easy way to harvest an animal. So we don't necessarily know that they were hunting, but they were certainly taking advantage of any situation. Now, as far as the overkill hypothesis goes, so we're talking, you know, 14,000 years ago. And then all of a sudden, near the end of the Pleistocene, we see a massive loss of particularly mastodon and mammoth. Okay. Bison antiquus is still very present. Equine species, so Paleolithic horse, they're still around. Okay. We've still got camels. Some of the larger sloths are dying off, but this wasn't an overnight thing. All right. There was things put into play environmentally, ecologically, that combined with a bunch of different factors could also have been a change in that climate that created disease among all these animals because of a rapid change in climate, i.e. the Younger Dryas impact, various things like that. So we don't know all of the ins and outs, and it could very well and most likely was a combination of all of these things. But now we have to back up a little bit, because are we to believe that Clovis Technocomplex just showed up and did all of this damage, right? Because everybody up to this point has been saying the Clovis were the first. Okay, they were the first people here. And before that, people like Arlis Herlechka was a gatekeeper who said that there's nobody could have been here at that time. That's just ridiculous. Nobody could have been here 14,000 years ago. There's absolutely no way. Well, he refused to acknowledge any of the Clovis artifacts. He refused to acknowledge that they were of the time period that was being indicated. So that backs us up to 14,000 years, right? Yeah. So if we're talking overkill and Clovis were the first people here, why was it them that killed everything? Because now what I'm getting at is there's ample evidence that there were people in North America 23,000 years ago. Why didn't they kill off everything? You know, why weren't they the ones that were eliminating? Well, people say, well, there was a smaller population. And this is news. This has recently just happened, where people are still trying to wrap their minds around the fact that we have good, solid, clear indicators that people were in North America 23,000 years ago. And what I'm talking about is the White Sands National Park. So people who listen to your show are probably familiar with the White Sands testing range. Same area.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
At that property, there's what's called Lake Otero, and that is an ancient lake right there in the middle of central New Mexico, but at the time was a 1,600 square mile lake, all right? And then it was formed when the Rio Grande there blocked the Tularosa Basin, and it used to run out to the sea, but it blocked it off, and it caused the water to collect and create this massive basin. So about 12,000 years ago, as the ice age ended and the climate changed, all of that began to evaporate, and it left what's called a playa, or a dry lake bed. And that's what we have there today. So that lake bed has become a masterful place to go look for archaeological evidence, because it preserves things like footprints very, very well of animals. And so they have found, you know, things such as mammoths, Harlan's ground sloth, camels, all of these type of things preserved. However, the latest research shows that 23,000 years ago, wait a minute, here's a bunch of human footprints. What are these doing here? And of course, how do we get that number, right? How do we figure out it's 23,000 years ago? So they tested seeds, they tested grasses, they tested other things that were found in situ with those, and came up with those dates. Well, of course, a lot of people were skeptical and said, no, there's no way, got to be wrong. Science, you know, there's no way, there's fallible things there that can happen. Well, we just had several, I think three or four more teams that went out and tested all of this stuff independently and came up with the exact same conclusions. So we literally have the footprints of people walking on the edge of that basin, of that lake, 23,000 years ago. Now, in addition to that, they've even found footprints that are inside footprints of a Harlan's ground sloth. So these people were stalking this sloth across this area. Literally human footprints inside of sloth footprints 23,000 years ago. And that's the type of thing I say when we keep backing up the clock. Okay, just between now and 14,000 years ago is a very long time.
Yes.
14,000 to 23,000 is a very long time. So who was there 23,000 years ago and where did they come from? And if we've backed the clock up to 23,000, are eventually we going to have to back it up to 50, 75? Where does it end? And really, that's the beauty of archaeology. And it's one thing that I love about it so much is, you know, Paul, when you work in this field, you have to be able and ready and willing to throw away everything that you thought you knew. Yes. Because, you know, everything that we think we know about history is very skewed. Unless it's recent history, we're probably wrong about most everything.
Yes.
You know, we think we have it all figured out, but in reality, especially when you're talking something 14,000 years ago, we're most likely wrong about most of our conclusions, you know? And if you could go back and actually see it, you'd be like, oh man, I'm so stupid. Like, yeah, it's that easy, right? I didn't even think about that. So, you know, my point being is, as we begin to back up this record, you know, North America's never had antiquity like that. We're always the new guys, you know, the new country that doesn't really have that ancient history like you see in Europe, but we do. And we're finally starting to discover it.
I mean, I just can't get my head around why people just can't comprehend that people would live there, Jason. I know often it's a joke. You know, I often hear people talk when I listen to other podcasts and they say, oh, yeah, I live in this really old house. It was built in 1920. And I'm thinking, I grew up in a house built in 1746, you know, 30 years before the American Revolutionary War. And so when I look at our history, I mean, where I live here in the north of England, near here is a place called Creswell Crags, where the earliest evidence of cave art in the United Kingdom exists, which is from 13,000 years ago. We've discovered, I think it was 2010, we discovered flint tools in Norfolk, which have been dated to 900,000 years ago, Jason. So I can't understand why someone could look at that information and that evidence and that history based in North America and go, yeah, I don't think anybody was here 24,000 years ago. And you're like, well, hang on. If they managed to get to the UK nearly a million years ago and were able to create tools, I do not understand why you would not think that that could apply on your side of the Atlantic, if not more so.
No, it's great points all around. And you also have to keep in mind that during the Ice Age, the factors of life were completely different. So much of the ocean water was in a frozen state. So the ocean levels were much, much lower than they are today, making, you know, literally millions of square miles of land accessible that today you wouldn't even think about. I mean, literally here in Charleston, you could go an extra 100 miles straight out into the what's today the ocean and still be on land in the Ice Age. So we are not always looking at it holistically from what did it look like when these people were here? What was the temperatures like? What was available for food sources? And again, that word migration, people always say, well, they migrated into North America. They may not have. They may have just simply been doing what they do. They might not have said, you know, consciously, let's go migrate. Let's leave where we're at and go somewhere new. They may have just been following the food source, adjusting to the climate change, and during that Ice Age, found themselves here in North America. And it could be as simple as that. And plus, as you're moving down through the continent, okay, you're getting better weather as you get closer to the equator. All right, so why not keep going? Hey, this is pretty nice. Okay, it's not as cold. We don't have to wear these furs and stuff as much. So, you know, it's again, people need to realize that the Clovis people were exactly like us. They weren't a different species. They weren't anything. They were us, extremely intelligent, able to adapt. And then of course, you know, people come up with these type of questions. Well, how did they know how to do that? Or how would they have done this or done that. Look, when you live outside 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, you figure stuff out really quick. All right. So when your life depends on knowing these things, when your family's life depends on knowing these things, you can adapt to things quickly. You figure things out. You understand how to get business done. Because Paul, if you do not, the repercussion is death. So it's a very black and white world back then. So if there was something available to them that was easy access, that would have provided an easier life for them, of course they're going to exploit that, whether it's 14,000 years ago, 23,000 years ago, or 100,000 years ago. Now, I'm an evidence-based person, so some of that speculation of 100,000 years, but I'm open to the fact that if you can show me and provide me good, clear, solid evidence, I'm okay with that. You know, so many people have that aversion to wanting to change. Everything I've written, I will throw in the trash can right now if you can provide good, solid evidence that's factual, repeatable, and everybody is on board. I'm totally fine. Rewrite the history books. I don't care. That's why you do archaeology. You don't do this to reaffirm the same thing that we already know over and over and over again. We already know that. Yeah, that's good. Let's go find something new because we know we're missing huge pieces of the puzzle internationally. You know, I think oftentimes about China. You know, what is the archaeological record in places like that that we can't get into? You can only imagine, you know, what might be in a place like that? What might be in a place like that that might relate to what we're talking about here tonight of the Clovis Techno Complex in North America? You know, all of those things. And so we should constantly be looking. You should want to change the narrative because that's science. That's understanding. And like I said earlier, we know we're wrong about most of this stuff anyway. So let's clarify what we can.
Well, I've always thought, Jason, that archaeology is probably the most malleable science because it has, even in our lifetime, it has changed so much. Our understanding of our history and the migration of peoples around the world. You only have to look at the last 50 years to see what we thought we knew to what we know now. They're essentially different histories, really. And I've often found this criticism about archaeology or gatekeeping of it ludicrous, I think, because even for somebody with a passing interest, which for me is I'm interested. I'll read about things. I like to watch documentaries about such discoveries. I like to blow my own mind by finding out how clever some of these cultures were in the past, despite what some people have said previously about their limitations, which we know is nonsensical because you couldn't exist in an environment like that without a level of intelligence that would rise you above your cohorts, as it were. And so when you have these kind of aspects, I don't understand why we don't consider the fact that some of these peoples may have escaped environmental challenges, not necessarily just sort of climate change, but we know what a volatile planet we live on. You only have to look at the volcanic activity that we're aware of in the last 100 years when we've really sort of been studying it. And look at, as we've been touching about the Younger Dryas period, that was basically people claiming that there was a bit of warming in the environment and people going, well, why did that happen? Oh, well, we think a comet might have landed in an ice field, which conveniently doesn't leave any evidence. There's a lot of theories like this that come forward. Tunguska is another one where somebody's said, oh, I think it's a methane volcano, which doesn't leave evidence. Well, We could all say that then, really, because if it doesn't leave any evidence, you can't prove your hypothesis. But there's nothing to tell us, if we believe that these peoples are so intelligent, that they wouldn't be escaping things like volcanoes, or they lived in environments where earthquakes had occurred, and they made a decision as a culture to get away from it. You know, you only have to look at the whole Ring of Fire, which is obviously the west coast of the US down into South America and everywhere on the opposite side of the Pacific, Jason, to see this is a volatile region even today. I can only imagine it was probably far more volatile when we're looking at it 50,000, 100,000 years ago. And so when you look at some of the aspects to the east of the US, islands in the Caribbean, Greenland, Iceland. These are all highly seismic areas, either for earthquakes or volcanoes or tsunamis. All these things occur in those particular areas. These are all driving forces, because if people didn't react to these kind of cataclysmic events, we wouldn't be here today.
You're exactly right, Paul. It's that ongoing drive of the human spirit to, you know, push on, to continue the species, to get out of danger's way. And a lot of this stuff is just basic common sense. You know, just as today you would avoid something that was obviously going to affect you and your family. You know, it's a flood zone. Hey, we're going to have a hurricane. You know, we just had a tropical storm here 3 days ago. If you live in a flood zone, common sense tells you to move, to get out of the way, right? But you know, we know they always have a few special folks that don't take heed to those warnings, and oftentimes they end up paying the ultimate price. But the idea here is that the human drive is extremely strong, and people figure out their environments. They figure out what needs to be done. They can make adjustments. They can make changes as needed. And, you know, from an archaeological standpoint, one thing that I really am happy about with archaeology here in 2024 is the way that it is changing. So we're seeing a lot less actual physical excavation where we're digging stuff up, because we have things like ground penetrating radar, LIDAR, all of these different things, you know, laser scanning, all of these things that can be used to give you a better picture of what you're looking at versus necessarily having to go out there and dig everything up. Not only is digging destructive, but it takes forever, you know, because when you're going down literally centimeter by centimeter with a trowel in your hand, and you're working a 2 by 2 meter square, and you're going to work on that one square for 3 months, that's your field school. You know, you're not able to get a whole lot of the picture. It's the same thing we see at Göbekli Tepe. You know, that's not a real big place, but there's obviously been many of them found through ground penetrating radar, more circles in that vicinity, other areas that need to be explored. They're all around there, but you have to move at that very slow rate, because A, you don't want to damage something. B, you want to make sure you don't miss something. And at the same time, you want to make sure that you're interpreting the record correctly. So there's reasons for it. But with the advent of technology, we're able to see so much more. A good example is, if you may have seen this story, a couple of years ago down in Guatemala, they did a LIDAR scan over the jungle for Mayan sites. Okay. And the experts at the time said, you know, based off of what we've seen, we're thinking we'll probably find, you know, maybe upwards of a dozen new sites. The LIDAR scan came back with a clear, concise hit on 60,000 new structures.
Yes.
Under the jungle canopy. Absolutely insane. That's 2,000 years worth of archaeological work at a minimum. And that's if you had a lot more archaeologists than you have today. So another thing that I think is very interesting, and I'll kind of close with this point, talking about the technology, is something like blood residue analysis. Okay, so this is something that was done here recently by a good friend of mine, Dr. Christopher Moore. He's got a paper out on this where he took 120 Paleo-American, from that time period, stone implements, and now they've learned that those little cracks and crevices that you have in a piece of stone, well, guess what? They hold blood protein, even after all of these years. So fur, hair, flesh, blood, all of those things get jammed up in those little cracks. So they went and tested 120 of these. It's the biggest immunological study that I've seen here in the Eastern US. And what they're looking to do is actually see what comes back, what kind of proteins come back, what were they hunting with these implements? And what they found is, of course, not every single one had a direct hit, but many of them did. And it came back with proboscidea, so mammoth, mastodon, came back with equine species, so horse, and mostly bovine species. So that would have been bison antiquus, which is very similar to our bison today, but bigger, larger. So they did find all three of those in very clear, concise blood residue. And again, that's amazing, Paul, not only to say here is the artifact, but this is what it was used to kill or to butcher. And so then again, we see a little bit, got one more puzzle piece, right, to stick in there and try to understand who these people were. But as we continue to do this, as we continue to try to understand the world of archaeology, a great thing that we are seeing with archaeology is today we are bringing in geologists. We're bringing in biologists. We're bringing in other scientific disciplines of people who can come to an archaeological site. You know, there's a discipline now called zooarchaeology where they just study the animal remains that are found on an archaeological site. Okay, so that can tell you about domestication. That can tell you about food sources. That can tell you about something that they may have had as a pet. You know, something that may have been buried in such a way that indicates that it meant something to the people. So again, we're able to see more of ourselves in the past. Again, we really have to stop looking at people from the past as lesser than, that just because we have a cell phone that we're the height of civilization. You know, because take a few minutes and look. Look at the ancient Greeks. Look at the Egyptians, the Romans. Look at the indigenous folks in Australia who are some of the oldest bloodlines anywhere in the world, and discover, you know, for yourself that humans have done some really remarkable things. Look at the Antikytherin mechanism that was found. You know, yes. That was not supposed to exist. Nothing like that was supposed to exist. And that's why it shook the world so hard, because everybody's like, okay, you know, how do we even begin to process something like this? Like, this is not supposed to be here. You know, no one is supposed to know how to do this. And so that was the same thing. You know, the Clovis point was the Antikythera mechanism of North America. When they found these points and then you realize how difficult these are to make, you're like, you're not supposed to be able to do this. And so the fascination continues, which is why, you know, as people continue to learn about the Clovis Techno Complex and who these people were, it's fascinating, and it's drawn a lot more interest. And of course, that's led to more funding for people to get out and look at these archaeological sites and do more reports like we did with the blood residue analysis that we talked about earlier. So I'm excited about what's going on here in North America. I love international archaeology as well, but it's good to see that we have all of these things sort of pushing the narrative forward here in North America.
I suppose as well, there are two aspects as well that I think are quite intriguing about them. On top of everything else we've mentioned, Jason, is this obsession, it would seem, to use red ochre everywhere. There seems to be a lot of sites where this seems to be special for whatever reason. And I think often, as we've said several times during this conversation, people will often presume why something is there or what its purpose was. Because along with this abundant use of red ochre and a lot of the sites that have been discovered, are also these deposits that are known as cache, where it seems that they've left a number of tools for a specific reason. And I've seen various standpoints on what they're for, from people saying that it's a ritual thing, which I think is often a very easy explanation for something you're not really sure why it's happened, Jason, or that perhaps these people are leaving these things as a hunter these days has a cache, where they have specific locations where they will leave food, supplies, armaments. And you would suggest if they're leaving tools there, they probably would have left food, clothing, whatever, that's maybe rotted because it was natural resources. And therefore, the only thing we're left with is the remnants of the tools.
No, you're exactly right. And earlier when I talked about Dr. Dennis Stanford talking about the movement of lithics from the east to the west, that's exactly how he determined that. He was finding caches across the country. And when he would trace the source of where did this material come from, it was coming from the east, not from the west. And so these things were being found further west than their sources in the east. And that's how he began to come up with the hypothesis of, wait a minute, why does this keep happening? Why do we keep seeing materials from the east ending up in the west? You know, what's going on here? And so, again, everything that we think that we know. And then the red ochre you talk about, okay, that's international. You see that everywhere, okay? Yeah. Often with a burial. Even the Anzac burial, that one Clovis burial that we talked about earlier, and that child was reinterred by indigenous people here in North America. But that child was buried with red ochre and a multitude of Clovis implements. So again, we see the care. We see the fact that even though these points would have been very valuable, because really the point, the lithic stone, is what is between you and life and death. And so to leave those with a child meant that that child meant something to them, strong enough and with enough love and care that he was buried, wrapped, again, materials hard to come by, with these stone implements, and then the addition of something like a red ochre or an ironite powder, something of those, that color. You know, we don't know what it means, but it is often in a burial context. Later on, much later, when we see the beginning of the mound building cultures like the Adena and the Hopewell in the Ohio Valley, again, the presence of red ochre is often found in burials. And it may be indicative of the blood, the life, but we don't know. We can't prove that. But whatever it means, it's always almost exclusively in a burial context.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
I suppose that in itself, as you say, when you look at the burial site, yes, you've got these implements, which shows a level of intelligence, a level of care, a level of love. But also, you would suggest that when we compare that to other cultures around the world, that also perhaps suggests that they're giving them tools that they'll need for their journey, wherever they may go, Jason, which then suggest that they have the concept or the construct of an afterlife, whatever form it may take. For all we know, they may believe that their spirits disappear on a giant mastodon and ride off towards the glacial boundaries. We don't know. We would be making it up. But when we look at other cultures, everybody left gifts or offerings or protection for whoever had been buried for their journey, be they Viking, Greek, Egyptian, ancient Britain, Celts, down into Africa. You've got it in Native American culture. You've got it in First Nations. You've got it down in Indigenous Australians. It's everywhere. And so, as we said earlier, we talk about this level of intelligence and this concept or this presumption that because people didn't have televisions and cars, they must have been stupid, which is ludicrous, really. They had the wherewithal to have the ability to understand the world around them far more than most people in this modern day would be able to do, Jason. You take a split group of the general populace and you plonk them in the middle of Montana and say, right, here you are. Here's a few sticks and some stones. we'll see you in 12 months.
Yeah, you're going to find bodies if you're lucky. And, you know, but it's the plight. It's the plight of the modern society. You know, most people in urban areas haven't seen the sky, in some cases, years. You know, because you look up and because of light pollution, buildings, structures, you can't see those things. And you get so caught up in your life, in the day-to-day, and whatever's happening in the world, that sometimes we forget about that part, that human beings are nature, but we like to separate ourselves from nature. We like to exclude ourselves in our air-conditioned homes, which I live in a very hot place, so I am more than thankful for that. And I enjoy the modern conveniences. We're using them right now. And, you know, how wonderful is this to be able to have discussions like this? So I'm not someone who, you know, knocks everything that's modern. I just think it's important to recognize there's different kinds of technology. There's different kinds of adaptation. And humans are remarkable in the way that regardless of what the situation is, they're always able to adapt and overcome. Whether it's Paleolithic Clovis technocomplex people hunting mastodons, or, you know, people today tracking a hurricane using modern technology and being able to get out of the way. You know, the things like that, all of this collectively together, each generation has its own story to tell. But ultimately, you know, my goal was to tell the story of some of the most inventive people here that we know of in early North America, Northern Mexico, South and Central America, because it's a fascinating thing. And you think about that time period when there's dire wolves, saber-toothed cats, mammoths, mastodons, camels, the American lion, which most people haven't even heard of. The American lion was an absolute beast, much bigger, much stronger than the African lion. And it was not something that you want to play with. But all these things were still there. So again, you think it's me, my wife or spouse or partner, and maybe two kids, if you're lucky, against the world. And you got to think that there had to be, during all that time, many cases where you turn the wrong corner on that mountain path and it's you and a saber-toothed cat and a sharp pointy rock between you and him. And that's all you have to defend your family is a sharp pointy rock on the end of a stick. But yet they made it, they overcome, they adapt. That lineage continues today with our indigenous people here in North America who can trace their lineage back and even beyond that. But they're still here today. And I think that's important to recognize too, is not only looking at the past, but also recognizing that these people, these brilliant, adaptive, deeply religious people are still here today. I think that's all a very important point to all of this.
I think as well, before we sort of wrap up this fascinating subject, Jason, is that it clearly seems to be really developing some traction. I think often there's always this kind of, I think sometimes people looking on American science for whatever reason, there's this perception that they don't care enough, or they're not diligent enough, or they're not interested enough, Jason, which is clearly nonsense. And I think it's, once again, it's one of those, you look through the prism of your own international bias at other countries often, and you view them in whatever way you've been ingrained to feel about them, I think. And so I think sometimes if you sort of don't look into this, you probably think, oh, well, they're not really that fussed. I think it's obvious now that there seems to be a real momentum gathering here, that people have thought, well, we know enough about the history of the world to know that this can't just be 13,000 years ago. There must be 23,000 years ago. There has to be 50,000 years ago. It has to keep going backwards, because we know, as I said earlier on, we know people were here in the UK a million years ago. I find it very hard to believe that they wouldn't have reached North America at the same time. I just, that just doesn't make sense to me. And it's one of the, if anything, you would be wondering, why do we have evidence of cultures in places like Papua New Guinea or Indonesia or Fiji or Hawaii even, places that are, with the greatest respect, nowhere near anything else, especially in the Pacific. I mean, how the hell did anybody get to Australia and New Zealand then? Which was far, you know, it's not like here in Europe, people could walk to England in those days. In North America, you could walk from Siberia there. You couldn't walk to Australia or Fiji, and yet people found their way there. And once again, this comes back to one of the points we were talking about earlier on. This belief that only Europeans used boats. Well, how did anybody land anywhere in the Pacific? They weren't all riding around on lost palm trees, were they, for goodness sakes? They were clearly a culture of fisher. You live on an island, what's the most abundant food source you've got? It's fish. And how do you fish? You go into the sea.
And then ultimately, as humans do, as you're sitting on the beach one night, you go, what do you think's out there? Like, if we go a little bit further, what do you think we'll find? And of course, having an understanding of currents, having an understanding of seasonal patterns, when storms are going to come through, when they're not going to come through, when's going to be a favorable time to go out into the ocean. They're going to know when fish migrate through, what time of the year we're going to catch tuna. Next time we're going to catch swordfish. This time we can catch snapper, grouper, whatever the case may be. They understand all of those things. And so it's not that difficult to wrap your mind around the fact that a culture that's already utilizing boats and watercraft for fishing on a daily basis, why would you even really doubt that they could come up with a way to get out to these islands? And obviously they did, Paul, like you just said, we have the evidence that they were there. So You can't deny that. I mean, unless they flew, they had to get there with a boat, right? So, I mean, I don't really understand. I've never understood those aversions to those things within the academic world. And because, again, I think, you know, I'm a proof-driven person. I want to see evidence. But a lot of organic evidence doesn't last. And a boat is going to be made out of most likely wood materials. And those things are not going to preserve. You know, even today with the Clovis, all we really have is the stone. We know we're not seeing their materials. We're not seeing, think about all the things that they probably made out of wood. That have never preserved. So really, we're only able to understand that they had these stone points, and based off of the mammoth and mastodon kill / scavenge sites throughout North America, we can determine that they had this degree of interaction with these megafaunal creatures. And other than that, we know nothing.
And like we said, it scratched the surface. It's 95 years of sporadic excavation and investigation, Jason. And therefore, I think it's one of those that I think, personally, when you look at some of the things that are going on around the world in regards to archaeology, I think what North America is on the cusp of could be earth-shattering in regards to our understanding and development, both of North American history and also our history as a human populace. And I think it's one of those things where I'll expect it could happen tomorrow, it could happen in 10 years, that somebody's going to discover the mother lode somewhere. And then everything's, all bets are off, Jason.
You're right. And I happen to know right now of several excavations that are going on simultaneously that are turning up some absolutely jaw-dropping evidence. Unfortunately, I hate to tease, but we have to leave it there. But as it becomes available and these papers are published, we will certainly be talking about it on our podcast as well. And of course, you'll see it throughout, you know, journal Nature. You're going to see it all over the place. So there's some very, very exciting things coming, I have a feeling.
Well, Jason, I could keep talking to you all day, and I know far more now about everything than I did 2 hours ago, which is exactly what I was expecting by chatting with you. And so I'm very thankful for you sharing your knowledge and your patience with me as I try to keep up. So where can everybody read your first wonderful book and also keep up to date with your fascinating podcast and website, where many of the subjects we've covered, you discuss on a regular basis with your cohorts and guest presenters as well?
Yeah, well, thank you, Paul. Again, it's my pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan of your work as well. I've been a dedicated listener since the very beginning. But yeah, our podcast is called Seven Ages Audio Journal, and it is a history and archaeology based podcast. We do cover international topics, not just North American archaeology, but we do try to keep that vein going throughout there because we have a lot of listeners here in the States that want to hear about that. But yeah, we cover international topics and we usually release a new episode about every 3 weeks to 4 weeks. We can be found on all of your typical social media outlets. And the book that I've written is called Paleo-Indian Mammoth and Mastodon Kill Sites of North America. It is available through Amazon. And if you would like a autographed or signed copy, you can get me directly. That's jason@sevenages.org. I'd be happy to send that along. And of course, we'll always send you some of our famous Seven Ages stickers along with that. People love those. But yeah, we're out there. We're constantly making new stuff. We have a Patreon channel as well where we do several other podcasts. And you can always go on there and check out the Crosstime Pub, the Digging Deeper. We also have the Green Dragon Book Club, and we have Seven Ages Knox, which, Paul, you were so gracious to be on our second episode of. And that's where we get to dig a little bit more into the topics that your listeners are probably used to hearing here on Mysteries and Monsters. So again, all the places I can be found, just feel free to reach out to jason@sevenages.org, and I'm always happy to interact with listeners.
Fabulous. Thank you as always for your time and your conversation. It's been fascinating, like I say, because it's something that I'm so intrigued by, because there's clearly so much just out of reach at the moment, and I can't wait to see what happens. But thank you again for taking your time, and I'll put links to everything in the show notes. And thank you as always. You've been such a kind supporter over the years, and I remember the first time you ever messaged me, I was rather taken aback, Jason, as someone that listened to your work and Micah's as well. It made me think, yeah, I think I must be doing something right if I'm getting emails from people that I respect. So that was always a great source of humility for me, I think, to make me think, yeah, I'm doing all right here. No, so we're okay.
You're doing just fine, Paul. No, we're all in this together, and we're all podcasters. We all have interest in all of these things. And all of these things are connected more than people realize. And so much of what you cover on your show, what we cover on our show, if we could fill in the gaps, we would see that there's probably a lot more closely related there than anybody would give credit for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll just look for that Clovis Bigfoot burial site and we'll both be happy.
That'll be a game changer.
Jason, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.